Okay, so today we have Imad Georgi joining us. I really thank you for your time today, and I'm looking forward to our discussion.
Yeah, I am as well. Thanks for having me, Dave.
Absolutely. So let's start at the very beginning. Let's talk about your career path and sort of the different phases that you went through in your growth.
Yeah, geez, what a winding road. So I grew up in a first generation immigrant household, and my parents didn't know what a computer was, and I certainly didn't. And at 11, 12 years old, they got me a really old beat up machine, and it was all like a foreign language to me. And I locked myself, I remember, in the room for a week over the summer. And somehow came out of that room in a week coding my first game. And so, coding just sort of came natural. And from that point forward, from 12 years old on, I've been working in some tech job in some fashion or another. Like I was literally like beta testing games at one point where, games were coming in the mail. I'd get them well in advance of, all my friends. And I get paid by the bug, and I report them on a sheet of paper that I would post mail back. But hey, I was getting paid, and it was I'm making money while, a lot of my peers were worried about a bunch of other kids' stuff. And so I sort of grew up through the ranks that way. I remember one of the first jobs I had. I was putting computers together, actually. It wasn't even a coding job. And remember being in a warehouse where I was, I thought I was, at that point was in my teenage years, and it was a couple years in, and I thought I knew everything. And I had a literally like a Lebanese family, like a grandma and her son and then her grandson, and they were all just putting these like computers together. They couldn't speak a lick of English, and I took one look at them and I'm like, oh yeah, I could do this. And they put a computer together faster than I ever had before. And it was really my first lesson in humility and in knowing that, every day there's something to learn. And so I worked full time through high school. I worked full time through college. I'm out of college, really started in the consulting world. I worked for KPMG, and I had really no business even working for KPMG at the time. KPMG was advertising that the average number of years of experience of their consultants was 15 years of experience. It was one of those jobs that I got, I think, purely on confidence alone. I remember meeting with the partner for my first interview, and he made it very clear that he was just there as a favor to a friend who introduced us. I mean, the minute he asked me one question, tell me more about yourself, typical question you get. And I was ready. I had all my values mapped out and all that. Through some persistence, I ended up getting that job. So I did consulting for a few years, got into my first startup after that. Really just learned a lot, because I was young in my career. I got to travel, I got to work in all sorts of companies. And that was fun.
Yeah, funny story about KPMG. Actually, I was just getting off the plane to get here to LA this morning, and I was putting my computer back in my bag, and there's some people sitting right next to me on the seats waiting for their flight, and they're like, "Oh, KPMG is so expensive," I thought that was kind of funny.
Yep,
But
it's
sorry,
true.
please go ahead and continue though. You're talking about experiential stuff. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I, after KPMG, I learned so much there, and I remember they had a great mentoring program there, and in my mentoring session, I was happy coding and doing my thing, and I remember a mentor asking me like, "So, where do you want to be in 2 to 3 years?" And I had no idea. I just sort of said a manager, I guess, but I had no intention, of moving up. And I remember immediately, without flinching, she said, "Well, why not VP or CTO?" I looked at her, and it was a lesson to really dream big, and think bigger about what I'm doing in my career. So, after that, I joined a startup. I then became the chief architect at Macromedia before the Adobe acquisition. I was really involved with development of Flash, which I'm not sure is good or bad these days to claim. And then was, fortunate to work on a number of projects beyond that for a lot of enterprise brands. Three startups in the span of my career, doing a lot of data architecture, data engineering, analytics work. You know, the name of the game for me has always been transformations, Dave. So I moved up the ranks. I like to say I'm the techie who loves people. Moment, I believe my personal mission on this earth is to grow leaders. And was for CTO at a number of organizations where I had a number of fairly intense transformations. And that's what I've done for years, and started to really understand how to execute, how to scale architecture, and how to scale people, really how to grow leaders in a very tangible way. My latest stint was I was CTO at Experian, you know, a number of transformations there. I think they really relied on me to bring in more of that entrepreneurial spirit and that focus on execution. And now I run my own consulting practice where I serve other CTOs, CEOs in leading those transformations, as well as doing leadership development and coaching for CTOs and their teams.
Okay, so far you've been talking about a lot of career experiences that involve engineering focus, like as an IC, et cetera. So, you know, maybe you could talk about some of those roles that you started to dip your toe and get into the engineering management side of the ladder.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we all have had people in our careers that gave us a shot. And I was fortunate enough to have people like that. And, you know, I was hired by a rather large $3 billion company, Wolters Kluwer, to manage a team. You know, it was one of their more successful products. Up till that point, you know, I had been informally managing, I guess you want to say, and it just came out of my own passion, you know, for leadership development as well. But this was my first sort of official management role. And I led a small team of developers, testers, support people, BAs. Like it was end-to-end, but it was seven of us or so. And I reported to somebody who was not technical. And so there were all sorts of like lessons that were part of that, you know, managing up, you know, to somebody who was not technical but supportive. When I joined the team, there was one star developer where, you know, my business boss made sure to tell me, if you take care of anybody, you need to take care of him. Like, he is our star. And this guy had never reported to anybody technical, you know, so this was his first experience reporting to somebody like me. And it turns out, you know, as I started looking at his code, it really wasn't that great. and he kind of been, you know, pulling the wool over people's eyes intentionally or unintentionally. And so I did what I always do, you know, just kind of bring reality to the surface and go, hey, have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? Here's how we could do it better. And, you know, there was definitely some adjustment there. You know, for the next week or two after I started kind of commenting on his code, he showed up about on average 2 hours late to work. And I typically don't care about time, but you know, when you miss meetings with clients and things of that nature. So I remember sitting him down after our first week and saying, hey, you know, I know we're new, but you know, this sort of can't happen. And I sort of was drawing some boundary lines. I remember him nodding his head and just looking at me and going, you know, I really needed this talk. I need somebody to be an asshole in my life, you know. And he was really meant it as a compliment, you know. And I'm sitting there, you know, one week into management, and this is the feedback that I'm getting. So, you know, that was my induction into that. And we did some cool stuff. You know, we had this great idea, and this was like well before Google Docs, and I won't claim any credit to it at all. But we had this great idea about collaborative edit sharing and things of that nature. And it was not approved by our executives to work on, but we were close to the customers and we wanted to work on it. And we ended up working nights and weekends on it. And it made the company a ton of money. You know, the executives were not happy when we built it. We built it, we did a beta, and then we presented the results. But you know, I'm proud to be part of things like that where you focus on customer value. It's a little bit subversive, but you know, at the end of the day, you want to do the right thing, you know, no matter what, and you want to cut through the bureaucracy. So that was my first management gig, and there's a ton of stories there we can get into if we have time. Sure. Along that, yeah, go ahead, Dave.
No, I was going to say, sure, take your time. These are all great. Oh,
cool. Yeah. Okay, so another story in that first management gig was that same sort of star developer I'm in a meeting and a production incident comes up. And so obviously that's top priority. So, you know, we IM'd about it. And I said, hey, could you work on this? You know, and he came back and he said, I've got other priorities, which I thought was really weird. So I sort of reemphasized the point and got the same response. So I left the meeting and walked over to his cube and said, hey, you know, we need to do this. And he said, you know, he kept pushing back. I said, well, this is the top priority. I can't even believe I'm saying this to him. And then when I kind of had him cornered, he finally said, well, this is going to take me 3 days to do. Well, guess what? I knew exactly what needed to be done because I know the code. I told him, actually, you need to do 1, 2, and 3. You know, it was essentially a bunch of SQL queries we needed to revise. And I said, this is going to take no time. And I'll do it with you right now. And so that really pissed him off. And he grabbed his jacket and he said, well, maybe I'll just leave then.
And yeah, I said, well, that's kind of a fight or flight response I've seen sometimes with.
Oh yeah.
Being intimidated and they just leave or, you know, bolt, rage quit as it were.
Yeah. It's like a drama queen kind of mentality. And I was like, you know, I basically said, you know, don't bother coming back. And 2 hours later he came back and told me he decided to stay. and, you know, ultimately he didn't make it. He was the first person I fired, 6 months later, you know, along those lines, he was like sleeping at his cube and I had to have a conversation with him about sleeping at his cube and he thought he had a right to do that. It was just, that was my first employee. So I learned a lot.
That sounds pretty challenging actually.
Yeah.
So were you saying earlier that the person said it was going to take a real long time and you said, no, let's sit down and just do it right now. Was that the situation?
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing was the situation was the statement was it would take 3 days.
Right.
And I felt like we could just bang it out right then and there. It might take a day.
So I have, sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Dave.
I was just going to say, I have a really similar story with my organization probably about 4 or 5 years ago. And to make a long story short, I had an organization that I let choose technologies and they chose MongoDB. And this raises a lot of hackles with people and so forth. But for the longest time, maybe 18 months or so in the early days, we're doing a lot of R&D. There's a lot of thrash. There's a lot of changes to the business and the underlying models and all this kind of stuff. And MongoDB is really cute for that kind of stuff. It's squishy.
It really is.
You can just put anything in there. And as we began to grow up as a company, we were a data focused company, you know, hundreds of billions of rows and, you know, petabytes of data a month of streaming ingest, like some really hardcore data stuff and data products that came out of that. And so we hired more and more data engineers and data scientists and they did not like the Mongo, right? So I went to my team as well and I said, look, we need to get onto Postgres. Well, any relational database, but for them it was Postgres. And they're like, oh, it's going to take a quarter and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, long story short, I'm like, screw this. I wrote a app over the weekend that did the data migration. And it had like a little dead letter queue where all the garbage data went, just to be able to show them like, look guys and gals, this was what was in there. You guys were building a sandcastle on top of, or a house on top of sand basically. And you know, there was still like 20% more work to do, like going through the code and finding where it used to be Mongo code and using Connects or whatever they're using it, et cetera. But my point is that very often people largely overestimate. And that's the benefit of having a really strong technical background. Of course, I'm tooting my own horn, but every single CTO I've talked to in this series has that technical background and they can politely call bullshit when it's necessary, if you will.
So yeah, you need to be able to do that, you know? And I've learned too, it's, you know, some people do that to kind of protect themselves from previous trauma. You know, they've been burned when they've given an estimate or something, or there's a lack of trust with their boss previously, so they purposely pad the estimate. There's all sorts of root causes behind it, but, you know, as you said, the at the end of the day, you just got to be technical enough to know.
Yeah, absolutely. So from there, you said you had like that first gig was like a small 7-ish person team. Maybe what point were you going into like managing managers or like a much larger or organizational type structure.
Yeah. So it's funny you ask that, because it was almost like right after that, you know, I didn't spend very long as a manager. Granted, I was, I think, managing informally in other jobs anyway, but so in the company there, the company launched a major initiative globally. It was literally like a $60 million, 3-year complete replatforming of the architecture of their flagship platform. And it contained a number of products. And they were about a year into it. And the guy running it was probably one of the smartest guys I've ever worked with. Now, I wasn't working on the project at the time, but technically just very strong. And it was a massive project. I mean, there were, I think, 8 different outsourced vendors working on it. There were internal staff. There was a massive data architecture being worked on. You know, when you, if you're ever been part of a project where you're trying to either displace a legacy architecture or run in parallel, I mean, those are really, really risky projects. And by the way, ones that I've done many times over. So I have lots of, you know, experience with that, pros and cons. But, you know, they're about a year in, and, you know, this guy was leading the project. He never led anything at the scale, right? And he was effectively the CTO of the whole thing. And I think a year, and he sort of woke up one day and realized that he's dug himself a big hole and literally walked out the door the same day. So overnight, the company was left with no captain of the ship. And, you know, they started sort of putting some feelers out. Nobody wanted to lead it because, you know, at the ground floor, everyone sort of knew what a mess this was. You know, at the executive level, things looked green and things looked fine. And so they were kind of looking around, and literally everyone's running away from it. And I was like the little kid in the candy shop, you know, with my hand raised going, pick me, you know, because I love stuff like that. I love turnarounds. I love for someone to tell me this is a mess. You will never get any value out of it. And I'm like, oh yeah, watch this. You know, I gravitate towards those things. It's in my blood, you know, so I jumped at the chance. Everybody thought I was crazy. They named me the head of that initiative, and I immediately took responsibility for 10 to 12 teams right away.
Wow, that's a big jump, actually.
Oh, yeah. And my first day on the job, I literally got calls from my peers expressing condolences. This is how bad it was, right? So what I asked from the executives and the board, obviously this was the biggest investment in the company globally. So is I asked them for 30 days to do an assessment, right? And a big part of what I do today is those audits and based on the playbook. And, you know, I dug into the code. I talked to people. I talked to customers. I talked to the teams. I did a one-on-one with each and every member of the team. That's a lot of people. And I talked to everybody. And I think that also set the tone of what I value. Yep. And who I value, right? I did a full assessment. You know, what is the process we're using? How much budget are we using? You know, what's our strategy for outsourced vendors? What's our data architecture look like? What's our tech stack look like? Like just end to end, everything. What's our tech talent? What does our tech leadership look like? You know, everything. And came up with a new plan. And so, you know, I came up with a new plan. And one of the biggest discoveries in all of that was that for that year that they were in development before I took the project on, they were focusing primarily on building the UI. And a lot of the hard stuff, the back-end work, the business logic was really not done. But they were presenting to executives as if it was on track.
Right. I call that frosting the cake first and then baking the cake after.
You know? I like that. That's exactly what it was, you know, except everybody thought it was a cake. And I looked at it and went, whoa, we don't have a cake here. So I remember walking into the boardroom to present my assessment as well as my new plan and thinking to myself, you know, I'm either going to get fired today because I'm walking in the room having to tell a board of executives that they've been fooled. And no one likes to hear that. And usually they shoot the messenger, right? So,
well, but maybe in reality, they kind of already know that, you know.
So I think so. I think, and so I presented my findings. I presented my plan, which included changes to every layer of the project, you know, changing out the leadership that's under me, changing our process, consolidating our vendors and simplifying our accountability model with their deliverables, changing the data architecture, changing our process, like how we do Agile. Like there were all sorts of things that I had recommended. I laid it all out and there was like a pause in the room. Like it was a really long, I don't know, 30 seconds. And finally, the CEO kind of looked at me and said, you know, that's the most honest assessment we've had of this project. And to their credit, you know, they put all their support behind me and I started a massive turnaround and got that project in within the next 2 years, which was the time window. But we did it in a very different way. And, you know, that was a very long time ago. And, you know, the people I went to war with side by side, we're still friends. We still hang out. And that was like, I don't know, that was 20 years ago.
Yeah. Wow.
It really bonded us together. And I'm very proud of the fact that a lot of people grew in their careers. Some still with the company today and some have moved on, you know, to other roles, but they've all grown in one way or another. So it was a really, really good learning experience and a growth opportunity for me as well.
Yeah. So that's a pretty big jump from the first gig you had where you were managing seven people to jumping and managing what, seven or eight teams, if it were. You know, that's kind of a big jump. It's a trial by fire. And sometimes it's how the best growth happens. What I'm wondering, you know, besides the support from the senior execs and stuff, did you have, including the support from them potentially, did you have a support structure? Did you have mentorship, other people helping you out? Because that's quite a bit of skills to uptake all at once. What was your support net like?
Yeah, you know, I did have a good support. I think a big part of it, you know, number one was just my own sort of natural curiosity and the way I'm bent. You know, I sort of approach work, teams, life as if I'm in a maze. You know, I'm not the center of it. It's not about me. And the only way to really figure out the maze is to experience it. You know, you're going to hit dead ends and you're going to feel your way through and you're going to fail and you're going to succeed. As opposed to, like, I think a lot of leaders are like the, you know, the guy sitting on top of a hill and sort of pointing out at the forest down below and going, yeah, you know, I know all about that forest, but I've never actually been there. So I think this sort of concept of, you know, being in reality and understanding it and having a natural curiosity dig into root causes really helped me. But in terms of support network as well, you know, I got my master's in organizational leadership and, you know, had a good network of folks there. I was fortunate also to have a professor and mentor in Henry Cloud, who's most famous for his book on boundaries, called Boundaries, in fact. But there's a book that he wrote called Integrity, which is all about the courage to meet the demands of reality. It's all about leadership. And, you know, he really made an impact on me. At that time as well, I crossed paths with Ken Schwaber, one of the founding fathers of Scrum, and spending some time with him, just blew my mind. You know, just, I mean, you were kind of learning it at the feet of greatness. Every day there was a lesson of some sort or another. Internally, I had support too. You know, I had people that really wanted me to succeed personally and were helping me along. And my first boss on that job actually became my direct report, believe it or not. And that was what an interesting experience that was. You know, I was really kind of awkward about it. And he immediately stopped me in our first meeting and he said, let's not even talk about it. I'm your direct report now. I'm here to make an impact on the company. I'm here to help you. So let's go figure this out together. So just that humility, you know, I mean, here was somebody who had been in the company for 20 years, maybe, you know, and I was fairly new to the organization, and to be put in a situation like that and still have the humility and the focus to want to make an impact. And, you know, we became great friends after that. So just, you know, not just the support network, but also the actions of people around me really taught me a lot.
Yeah, that's a great analogy or a great anecdote, because you had someone who was willing to essentially self-demote in order to work for you. And that says a lot, in my opinion. I saw a similar thing at a major ride-sharing company that I used to consult for in their earliest days. And their original CTO had only a couple years of tech experience, believe it or not. And as they were raising more and more funds, more and more rounds, et cetera, that person purposely self-demoted, not once, but three more times in their career. And I still keep in touch. I come back and have lunch with them every so often. And now he's an engineering manager and he's happy about it because his equity offering didn't change. He was, you know, employee number two or one or whatever.
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, they've since swapped roles originally, the CTO and the VP of engineering. And then he just kept going all the way down the chain until he started again at the bottom and worked his way, and he's working his way back up now. And I thought that that was a really interesting story. And I've even used that in hiring and building teams too. It's like, look, this company may grow faster than you.
That's right.
Hopefully that doesn't matter to you because look how early you're in the ground floor here and et cetera. It really depends on a matrix of things. But that's saying a lot though, that that one of your bosses became your direct report. That's really cool. I've seen it now a couple times in analogy.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that, Dave. Yeah, I think it's a rare thing and it's a really powerful thing. And at the end of the day, like all of us leaders and otherwise, we want to be part of something greater than ourselves. But few people actually act in accordance with that, right? And so when you do see it's a powerful lesson.
I'd say the opposite of that in the org is what I call status jockeys, people who are self-serving right. And all of that. And you know, they don't always have the same arc in the long tail.
That's right.
You know, they're the kind of people that you may not refer to a gig or whatever. There's like a whole butterfly effect to working with people who are self-serving. And they may win in the short run, but in the long run, they don't. And in fact, there's a great book. And feel free to drop any of your book recommendations along the way. We've had a lot of good ones in this series.
Sure.
There's a book called Infinite Player. And it's about some people play to win and others play to play again. Right. And there's two different strategies. You either play to get immediate gratification or you play to play the game again and again and again for the sake of the game. And there's a whole different mindset there. I noticed as people mature, they tend to learn the latter, which is to play for the long game instead of just the win today. And so I thought I'd share that. It's called Infinite Player.
I love that. I have not read that. That's great.
The Infinite Player, if you will. Yeah.
The Infinite Player. I like that.
Unless you had any more anecdotes within that one org, if there's another company to jump to, still would love to hear what came after that.
Yeah, you know, I've worked for a number of enterprise brands, and you know, when I was, I've had several experiences. When I was at Experian, I was fortunate to have a number of roles there as well. And I remember when I first started there, you know. The companies that large are heavily matrixed, lots of different business units, each with their own accountability. So it's rare to kind of work together on stuff, at least at that time, right? In my first 6 months, you know, my role initially was as the global chief architect across all divisions. And part of that was kind of bringing techies together to work on common problems. And I think there was a readiness and a support by the executive team. By the way, I had a fantastic experience at Experian. I mean, just a great, great team there and giving me a lot of support. And they were ready to kind of bring the technology organization under me, report to me, and, you know, let's kind of go do this. And I remember standing up there my first 30 or 60 days in, and I basically told them, keep your budget and keep your direct reports. And let me go off as an individual contributor and see what I can do. Give me 6 months. Here are my goals. If I accomplish these goals, then you can give me all the budget and the direct reports. And I remember the executive just looking at me like, are you serious? Because we're ready to give this to you right now. And part of what I wanted to do is really set the tone from the beginning that even at an enterprise organization as large as Experian, we have to start to build momentum in the technology organization that's founded in desire, and that's founded in passion, and that's founded in people wanting to work on things, right? So I went on a whole campaign, started meeting teams globally, getting to know them, getting to know their products, getting to know their customers, getting to know their challenges, bringing like-minded people together. So it was almost like an internal LinkedIn, you know, if you will. But it was live, it was not online. It was like, you know, really connecting people and started working on problems together. And we started really, building a lot of energy and momentum. People were working on problems on their evenings and their weekends. And we started kind of building a movement, really, so that by the time we got to a place where we said, well, let's create a technology organization, it was sort of already there. You know, we were putting a structural stamp on it. And that was really representative of my time there and the number of roles that I had there, is really about bringing that entrepreneurial spirit into a large organization, focusing on execution, focusing on delivering customer value, focusing on developing leaders in very tangible ways and giving people growth opportunities and connecting them. And it was just an awesome, awesome first year there.
Cool. So since Experian, have you been doing primarily the consulting route then?
Yeah. So after I moved on from Experian, I started my own consulting practice. And I had a number of people sort of approach me and say, you know, you should really do this for more companies. And, you know, I developed this playbook on what constitutes a healthy technology strategy over the years, all grounded in execution, right? All grounded in real world knowledge. And as well as my passion for leadership development. You know, I mentioned earlier, I believe my mission on this earth is to grow other leaders in technology and to do it in a very, very sort of tangible way. And so I have been running my consulting practice now for the last 2 years, where I lead transformations for clients. Typically, it's companies that are growing and scaling. I work for CTOs and CEOs. I do the audits just as I did early in my career based on that playbook. We understand what the root causes are. Because, you know, a majority of the time, people are not making good decisions because they don't understand the root causes. And a lot of times they'll just tell you, well, I don't have the capacity to dig into that. Mm-hmm. I don't have the time to dig into that. But you have the time to spend millions of dollars on a solution that might be wrong. Right. So for me, you know, I can at least serve the role of really digging in, bridging the boardroom and the code review room, you know, developing code and developing leaders and getting to the truth of things and presenting those root causes. But in addition to that, I map the root causes to solutions and recommendations. Like, here's what I actually implement. And then we go from there. And then, you know, I might lead a transformation. I might lead a project on behalf of a client. So I do the audits and the operational sort of leading of projects. And then the third thing that I do is I do a lot of leadership development for CTOs and for their teams, where I take them through a leadership development a program that I built that's experiential and that tangibly takes them through capabilities. So I call it the technology leadership gym. So it's like leadership is a muscle. There's different muscles in the body that you exercise and you have to exercise them to get stronger. And there's different levels. You know, one of my leadership muscles might be accountability. Okay, what does that mean? And defining what is level one, level two, and level three of maturity look like in this accountability capability, and then taking people through that, right? So they can see their progression through it. And that's been used in all sorts of ways where, you know, you can incorporate that in like a career path in an organization where you tangibly define where you go from, you know, how do I get from manager to director? What does that mean? What are the capabilities I have? And then map people's experience against that baseline. So yeah. I love doing things like that and that coaching, but more than coaching, it's really taking people through a very tangible model and seeing them grow over time. It's really built a lot of friendships, and I feel very grateful to play a role in people's careers and helping companies scale through their people.
Yeah, that's great. I jokingly call this like restaurant makeovers. Only because, you know, there's so many TV shows about this where they come in and like, you know, it's all dramatic and stuff. But I doubt it's really that dramatic. But in my experience doing some of these kinds of things, a little less around leadership, but like around engineering process, talent, procurement, candidate experience, those kinds of things, I've had varying degrees of success. And certainly I've looked inwards as to why some of those things didn't come out as productive or fruitful as I wanted them to be. And I guess I can turn this statement into a question here. What I mean by that is, what's necessary for you when you're coming into a company? What are your prereqs in order to sort of guarantee success? Because you don't want to chalk up any fails on your own CV and your own you know, you want a feather in your cap every time with success, right? Everybody wants success. What do you require when you're engaging with the company in order to make sure everybody's going to win with your recommendations?
So there's a ton of stuff there. I mean, one thing I've learned is never, ever jump to the solution. You know, I, you know, as an engineer, naturally I'm jumping to solutions all the time, and they're in my head, and I've learned to not express them as much up front. And so I see sort of the ideas, you know, sometimes you just get a smell, as you know, from your experience, and you go, ooh, I know how to attack that one. Instead of kind of blurting it out, I really treat it as it's just a hypothesis in my head. Let me gather data and validate or invalidate that. So I think the first focus is trust, and it's building trust. If I can't build trust, I can't do my job, you know? And for me, because I'm a consultant, and I always say I suck as a consultant because, you know, I don't want to just report what the problem is. I want to actually make an impact. You know, I still have that in my blood. That's what I want to do. So I make it very clear to folks that I'm there to help grow and scale. That's what I'm about, you know? And I take the time to do one-on-ones with every member of the team, no matter how large the team is.
Yep.
I take the time to use the products. I take the time to talk to the customers. And I do this in a fairly intense, short window of time. Like, I have sort of perfected how fast I can do this. I talk to the executives, but I don't believe a word of a thing that anybody tells me in the first phase, right? I want to trust and verify because I want to understand. And that's no, you know, discredit to anybody there. It's just that my principle is I've got to learn things firsthand, you know, and if that helps me understand also who to rely on, right? So for a few clients, for example, I was brought in, essentially they're saying our dev team is not working. You know, they're just not working well. And then you dig in and you find, no, they're actually working very well. They're really hard workers, but the process sucks. You know, it's laborious and it's full of red tape and it's slowing them down. And right. So you start to understand root causes, right? And that builds trust, right? You start to understand impediments. You play a role in solving those impediments. You play a role in bringing truth to the surface. You know, I know as a CTO, there were times where I'd bring up an idea to a CEO and they might say, oh yeah, we'll do that later. But then a consultant comes in and says the same idea and all of a sudden, like, we're doing it, right? So I recognize that. I also have a serious responsibility for being a voice and an advocate for the team and for what the right things are for the company as well. So
yeah, absolutely. And inevitably you have a role as a change agent. Like you said, in a positive way, call that a treadmill effect. Like when you go to the gym, I'm going to go back to your gym example. And, you know, you're running on a treadmill and somebody comes up next to you and they start running as well. And they're running faster. Like nine times out of 10, you're going to inevitably pick up your pace subconsciously even. And when you have people coming around you and, you know, picking up the pace, et cetera, I've seen that in doing staff aug and high level engineering type engagements with teams, you get it there. But sometimes you don't. And that's kind of what I wanted to turn it around to is when you have, let's say you have a CTO and effectively they're your client, right? Your consultant to the CTO many times in these engagements. Yeah. What do you do when they either aren't uptaking everything or they're cherry picking the things they do and don't want to do? How do you hold them accountable when this situation happens?
Yeah, there's lots of situations like that. I mean, you know, accountability, I believe, needs to be transparent. I was going to say public and that seemed like too big of a word. I believe that accountability should be done in front of everyone and it should be okay to do. And to do that, you have to get everyone to align on what the baseline for performance is. Like, what are you holding people accountable to anyway? And there are all sorts of ways to do that, right? So there is a way to make it fun. Like, for example, with one client, we had an issue where teams were not really taking code quality very seriously, right? People were saying, well, you know, I'll do that later. You know, we're under pressure. We just got to get this thing out the door. And so we developed a game, right, where I kind of put together, like, what are the standard, like, what are the coding practices we want to engender, the ones that we're having a hard time sort of holding people accountable for, and what are the anti-patterns that we want people to avoid? I'm going to wait until this sign's over here. So we developed a game, So, you know, there were like 10 best practices and 10 anti-patterns, and you got plus points for implementing a best practice and minus points for anti-pattern. And the principle was you could always make your points back on any given day, and we start tracking it. And we didn't really make an announcement or roll out or any sort of bureaucratic stuff. We just started the game, and we literally week one posted scores by team. People started looking at the wall going, what is this score? Like, why our team get negative 50 this week?
Right,
what
is going on?
And it's like, then you start to get people who care, and you're like, oh, you're asking questions. Okay. Let me walk you through it. And then we kind of made it into a healthy competition.
Yep.
And that was kind of a fun way, but still kind of pointing the finger, you know, going, look, you're the lowest performing team. And then they start to self-adjust. So that's just one method, but I have all sorts of methods like that, that, you know, but the principle behind it is accountability is public.
Yep. Hey, one quick analogy or one quick tool there that's great for that. And I absolutely 100% agree with getting it out in the open. And a lot of companies you visit, they have the like 6 or 10 monitors up on the wall with all their stats and their log stats, and stats D, whatever, Grafana, there's a bunch of them. And I found a really good use for one of those monitors is to run Gorse. I'm not sure if you've ever heard of Gorse.
I have, yes.
Okay, so yeah, we would do that too. So we would basically take all the active repos for a given team near that monitor and just run a Gorse job every night or whatever, every week. Usually it was nightlies. And it goes back during the whole cycle. Maybe it's a quarter long or maybe it's an initiative. And it's running. And even people who are visiting the office are like, oh, what's that? That's cool. And we went all the way. We put people's avatars in there. And
oh, I love it.
There's a lot of data in there that's very subtle. Now, it's not to like, in, you know, impact people to want to feel the need to work around the clock or on the weekends. However, anecdotally, you saw two major things stand out. You would see people who were kicking butt and they did give enough of a care to work on the weekends and or they were working a lot and all the time. And it's not a game, but it is a game, right? So when you look at it, you could literally 9 times out of 10 see the top performer on the team. And often it's the tech lead. So you might expect that, but it depends on how much they code. Some tech leads are more of a supportive role, so you won't see them on the Gorse. Right. But you'll see these people just bouncing around and it's buzzing. And I'll put a link to Gorse in the notes from this podcast. But also you see the opposite effect. Like, let's say you're one-on-one-ing with the whole team and they're like, yeah, Bob over there is not doing so well. We think his cat's sick or whatever's going on in life happens. And you'll see it show up in the fact that Bob's not really actually doing any work either.
Oh, yeah.
The team's carrying Bob because they like Bob. But really, Bob's not working. And so without that feedback from all those one-on-ones, you could also see it in a course as well. Now, granted, there's like things in Git, like squash merges and things that might hide information. So it depends on how the team uses GitHub to be able to map it to Gorse. But anyways.
Yeah, Gorse is fun to use. And
great tool.
I've used other tools too. But I remember that, thanks for that call out. I remember something you just triggered, what you just said. I remember sitting down with a developer on one project where he was insisting that he was the most productive developer. And then when you kind of ran the metrics against Git, you found like, actually he only has a couple commits per month.
Right. And they're taking new lines out and tabbing the code in and out. Sometimes.
There you go. And it's like, you know, to the average eye, it's like, oh yeah, okay. You've got regular commits. Cool. So I think, you know, bringing that to the surface where everyone's on the same playing field and being measured the same way, just like you're on a sports team, you know, if you're having a bad shooting night or a good shooting night, and then you go see coaching or you go figure out what to do for the next game. But everybody knows, and everybody knows you contributed to the loss or the win, and it's fine. And you move on, you know, and you do something about it. That's what we need to get to. And I always say that, you know, the way you know you're in a good technology culture is when those things stick out, when anti-patterns stick out.
Yeah.
When anti-patterns hide, you know you're not – you're in a culture that has some systemic issues, right?
Yep.
And so you want to get it to a place where things stick out very quickly.
Totally. I always say that which is observed is respected. So as much as you get out in the open, you know, like if you put a camera in the company's kitchen, people won't leave dirty dishes in the sink because they know that that it's going to go back to replay and then they'll know, you know. I'm being facetious a bit, but I've actually we needed to do that in a company once just because, you know, if it's like observed, you know, you're going to behave properly.
I totally agree.
All right. So with that, I think we had a really good tour through your career history and so forth, all the way from engineering IC. And you actually mentioned something I was going to ask you anyways, which was what kind of education did you have? Because I was starting to think you had some kind of org psych or org development type of educational background, just based on all of the transformative work you've done and the leadership and so forth. So what I want to do next is shift gears and go into the types of things that you do within your organization to actually foster the individual contributors' growth and the overall arc of their career path. You know, how do we manage this for the long haul? Because granted, unless they're straight out of college, they aren't coming in cold. They've worked somewhere else and they want to get to somewhere else. So in the next segment, we're going to talk about, you know, some of those strategies, some of the tactics you've used, not only just directly with the team, but even how you scale that up into an org. So let's discuss that next.
Great. So Dave, you asked me a juicy question all about scaling, and specifically scaling people, you know, starting from the individual and, you know, how do you grow a team? And I think there are things that, you know, as a leader, you have to do early on to set the tone as you move forward. So, you know, we all talk about technical debt all the time. And I think early on in a company, there are decisions that you make that can impact the trajectory of, you know, how durable your applications are. You know, companies don't wake up one day and just have to rewrite an application. That happens over a series of small decisions over time that oftentimes are not very visible. And then all of a sudden, you know, 3 or 4 years later, you've got a quote unquote legacy application, which I have a philosophy about that terminology you can get into. you know, because legacy is a good thing, isn't it? Like everybody wants to leave a legacy behind in their life. It's a positive thing, isn't it? Like it's paying our salaries, isn't it? There's all sorts of things, you know. Anyway, I can get into that later if we want. But, you know, you don't wake up 4 years later and go, oh, my God, I have a legacy application. I've got to now spend, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars to write it somehow. Though that happens over, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of decisions over time made at the ground level by the individuals on the team that affect the durability of the application long term. So that's technical debt. We talk about that all the time. What we don't talk about is a bigger crisis I believe is going on in technology today, which is leadership debt. And very much in the same way, you know, when you're talking about scaling teams, you really want to be cognizant and aware of the decisions as a leader that you're making that may impact the long-term durability of your team. And, you know, we don't talk about it often enough, but everybody feels it. And I believe that every technology problem comes down to leadership debt of some sort or another, past or present, right? So one of the focuses that I have in helping organizations grow and scale so that when they scale forever. They scale for the long term and well beyond my presence with them. You know, I really relish that as well, is, you know, really focusing on what does it mean to really lead the organization the right way? And what does it mean to grow? And if you start at the individual level, I'll give you kind of a small tactical example, and then I'll stop for some comments. But whenever I go into an engagement, and I did this also well beyond, you know, well before I was a consultant, even as a CTO, no matter how large my team is, small or large, the first thing that I do is I have a one-on-one with every person on the team. And if that takes a couple weeks, that takes a couple weeks. And the reason there are multiple reasons for doing that. One is get to know your organization. You know, don't take a manager's word for it. Don't take a director's word for it. You know, get in the weeds, because we're engineers. That's what we do. We do that with code. Why don't we do that with people? So the first thing I always do is set the tone, is get to know your people. You know, and you don't have to believe everything they say. You obviously want to trust but verify, and everyone has opinions, and some people are more political than others and have agendas, and, you know, there's all sorts of stuff, right, that you sort through, but get in the weeds, right? And what that does beyond you sort of learning firsthand, which I think that as a leader, your first goal in the scaling journey is to understand reality. And so you can't understand reality without getting into the weeds with people on the code, right? But the other thing that it actually does is it sends a message to the whole team about what your priorities are.
Yep.
And, you know, your priorities, you're saying, I have this big job, right? You know, I'm the leader of the group, or I'm a consultant coming in under a very sort of crunched time. But what I'm choosing to use my time right now is with you, the team. And that really sets the tone to, you know, there were times where I had a very quick one-on-one with somebody, you know, it was like 15 minutes and we were done. Like, we didn't really have much to share. And that person came back and said, you know, I'll never forgot the fact that I did that, right? It's something that was imprinted that, okay, this is the kind of person that I'm working for, this kind of leader that I have, this is the kind of team that we're going to be. Like, this is what's going to be important to us. And it starts there, because, you know, your first job is to understand reality, but very close to that as a leader is to build trust, you know? And one of the things that I love to do with teams and with all my teams in the past is really, you know, deliberately not changing anyone on the team and seeing sort of what you get by maximizing what we can do together if you have trust and you sort of set up the situation the right way. That's not to say that, you know, of course we can add to the team, but building that concept of, like, you know, I believe there are hidden gems in every organization, right? There are people that just need a particular shot. And even code assets that have been forgotten, that if you just look at it in a different way, you know, it might even turn into an adjacent product that you never even thought of, right? So, you know, if you give people that, you know, framework, that ecosystem, that we believe in you, here's the opportunity, let's go do this together. You know, I've done some, you know, miracles, I think, and it's not me doing them, it's the team. Like, they've always had that in them. You know, they just needed an ecosystem where they could participate more fully. And I've had teams that, like, had been with the company for years and had been written off. And then all of a sudden they go, they're delivering like the fastest revenue growing product in the company because they had a particular, you know, opportunity. So I think, you know, understanding reality and building trust, and we can talk more about that, but those are the first two primary goals of starting to scale teams. Because then, you know, as you start to add people, you know, everyone knows what this team is about, what principles we stand for, and they know it through actions, not through, you know, an all hands deck that you present once a month.
Right. Absolutely. Your culture is like what you do. It's not just like, you know, 15 core values you write down on the wall and everybody walks by it every day, sort of ignores it, you know?
Yeah, culture is like this ambiguous thing that often we point to other people to say, you know, the culture sucks or the culture's great, or, you know, it's always about someone else. I believe that culture is simply the stories that you tell every day. Like, it's a personal ownership thing. Like, if you spent your day, you know, whining and complaining about the company, well, congratulations, that's your contribution to the company's culture that day. Or if you spend your day really delivering customer value, getting stuff done, helping your peers, you know, really being a leader, whatever position you are, well, then that's your contribution to the culture, right? But it's a personal ownership issue. That's what I believe about culture.
Yeah, definitely. So going back over to, you know, growth, pathing, et cetera, you know, in the environments you've been in, to what extent is that out in the open? Like, are people openly, you know, manage their goals, et cetera? How do you keep track of all that and make sure people are well engaged, et cetera?
Yeah, managing goals in general with a lot of the techies I work with, there are not a lot of good systems out there. Or people are just not doing it well, you know? So I really like this topic. So we'll unpack this a little bit. One of the things that I don't believe in is time-based promotions. Mm-hmm. So when someone comes in and says, oh, you know, in 6 months, you know, you'll be made director. Well, that's a red flag right there. I believe in goal-based career growth, right? So to do that, like, hey, I'm a manager, I want to become a director, right? To do that, you have to understand your baseline. Like, how am I doing as a manager? What does it mean to be a good technology manager in this organization? And then where do I map to that? Okay, What does it mean to be a good director? Okay, now I measure the gaps. And, you know, kind of taking more of an engineering mindset of defining these things very tangibly. And what I find is extremes. You know, companies either don't have this defined at all, and it's really kind of left up to the opinion of whoever you report to. You know, let alone trying to get, you know, a big picture sort of view of growth as a team, like your talent, your skill set, your seniority, your level of experience, you know, as a team, right? You don't even have that mindset or that insight as an individual. And then the other thing I see is like really laborious systems where you have to fill out all sorts of forms and there's this big, heavy process. And meanwhile, you have no idea where your career is going.
Yeah, that's a dead end. Absolutely.
Yep. So what I've done over the years is I actually built a leadership maturity ladder or program, if you call it that, around. So, okay. So at each level in the org, and you know, it has to obviously be customized to companies and what they're looking for, but at least it's starting off as a tangible standard. Like here are the five things that we look for in a good technology manager. Right. And some of those things may be around technical competence. Some of those things may be around particular leadership behaviors. Right. So you might say, hey, for someone to be a good technology manager, you know, they need to have a sense of ownership. OK, well, what does that mean? And, you know, if you tell somebody that, they'll say, yeah, great. I have a sense of ownership. Now what? You know, so, you know, I started to map that more tangibly to, OK, well, what does sense of ownership mean? Right. Well, level one sense of ownership are these behaviors. Level two are these behaviors. Level three are these behaviors. So sort of apply a maturity matrix to that. And then you work with people, you know, coaching people and whatnot, and you map them to it. You say, hey, okay, you're really high on ownership. You're really low on delegation. You're, you know, now let's work with you on that. Let's get you to level two delegation. Here's what I would like to see you be doing. And let's work on that over the next 60 days or whatever it might be. And so what that does is it changes the ballgame entirely, right? Because now you're giving people and teams a baseline of what is good, right? And you can apply that up and down the organization. What does it mean to be a good developer? I always ask that question, right, with companies. Tell me, what does it mean to be a good developer here? And it's really interesting to kind of see the answers. You can apply it all the way up to the top, like, ask a bunch of CEOs and board members, what does it mean to be a good CTO? You get to get a million different answers, right? You know, and usually you kind of hire the most confident voice in the room, which is not always the most confident, competent, sorry. So you give people a baseline, which is a really powerful thing. You know, there's people that are going to complain that they don't have a baseline. And then when they have the baseline, they're going to complain about where they stand in the baseline. So there's that aspect. But it's reality, and you're giving it tangibly and very clearly. So even if people don't agree, they can at least follow the logic, and they know that this standard is being applied to everybody else. And then you can build a program where you say, all right, well, here's your baseline on what it means to be a good technology manager in this example. Here's where I stand as in terms of what it means to be a good technology manager. Here's where I'm high. Here's where I'm low. Here's where I need some help. Cool. Now let's measure the gap between where you're at and getting to director, and then building a plan to get people there. And that becomes less of a time-based thing. Like, hey, if they close those gaps in the next day, I mean, highly unlikely, then great. You're ready for promotion. If it takes you a year or two, three, four, whatever, okay, fine. But now, instead of, you know, as a leader being irresponsible and setting a time frame, saying, hey, I'm going to promote you in 6 months, where the responsibility is on me as the leader now, like I have to follow up and make this promotion happen somehow and navigate my own political network to figure things out. Now it puts the onus back on the individual who wants to grow, which is the way it should be. We own our own careers.
Yep, because you've both identified a mountaintop that they're going to tackle, what they're going to go after, and they're aligned, right? The alignment with the company, the alignment with the individual, and then their own alignment with their own career path itself.
That's right. So now it's like the ball's in their court. You've set the standard. You've helped them map where they fit into that standard. You've set the future goal with them. You've mapped that very tangibly and where the gaps are. And now it's up to them. You know, it's like, all right, let's develop this path together and I will support you all the way. Now, of course, that assumes as an organization that you have the budget and the capacity to promote because, you know, you plan for success, right? If that person is going to then accomplish the goal, well, you need to be ready to then, you know, put your money where your mouth is, of course.
Right. What if you don't have another director spot, et cetera? Like, do you cycle them out amicably, actually, you know?
Sure. And all sorts of things pop up, like when you, and I'll maybe talk about this in a second, about how do you do career growth in an organization. If you're having regular conversations about it, you know, all sorts of different opportunities might pop up than you, what you originally expected. Right? That person might have been the one, be a director. And then as you work with them, they discover, you know what? I'm kind of interested in sales. You know, I want to go try some sales work. Okay, let's go talk about that, right? And maybe get their feet wet a little, try a little project in sales and see how it goes. And so, you know, things change all the time. Career growth paths are winding roads. They're not linear at all.
That's a good way that you kind of stitch that together because essentially you're showing how your growth on a continuous basis is heading towards some longer vector or place along the ladder, if you will, towards career path.
That's right.
You know, you can look at them in different perspectives, but you actually connected them two together. That was great. Sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, you have to, because you know, that's what people do. They connect these things. We just don't happen to do it in a corporate structure. You know, up until now, sort of using this framework that I put together. So one of the things too, that, you know, makes it work is that, you know, as a leader with direct reports, you know, I need to be having regular career growth conversations with my team. And everybody says that, and everybody says, oh yeah, we do that. But usually it's kind of the thing that falls off the plate, you know, especially when everyone's under pressure to deliver.
Yep. That in retrospectives.
Oh yeah. Oh, don't get me started on that. That is such a pet peeve of mine. Like, there's no excuse not to do a retrospective. I mean, the concept is like, we're trying to learn, like we're trying to look back and go figure out, what did we do well? What do we need to adjust? And if you don't have time to do that, like you're not getting better. It's such a pet peeve of mine. But anyway, in terms of career growth, what I like, and I'm a little bit more, I don't know. I don't see many people commit to this, and I'm a big believer in it. I believe that you need to have a one-on-one with your direct reports every week. There are exceptions. You may say, hey, you know, we have a particular cadence. We may do it every other week. That's fine. Let's call it minimum twice a month. So 2 to 4 times a month. And usually in that one-on-one, it's their time. So if I'm their boss, right, it's their time. So, you know, they can come to the table with anything they want to discuss. And then I usually have some prepared feedback. So I'm typically, and my expectation of leaders is to do this, is to take notes during that week or during that two-week period where you're observing the person in meetings or during the project. What did they do well? Did they not do well? I keep an Evernote, you know, on each person, essentially. And they're my notes. But then when I have those sessions, it's really easy because I can just pop it up. I don't have to remember, you know, and I try to be very, very specific on examples. So if I write something down like, ooh, this person did not show a good sense of ownership today, I'll actually write down specifically what happened so that I can recall it. And I believe that giving specific examples, you know, allows people to wrestle with it better and allows people to adjust better.
Yep, that's great. The impact of that's so much better than just two thumbs up or finger guns and saying thanks. and not even for what, you know. No, absolutely. That's a very valuable way to give feedback. I like that a lot.
Yeah, like, you know, with recognition, for example, I coach people that, you know, don't say great job. Don't say thank you. Like, you know, someone's been up for, you know, 48 hours doing a deployment and you say thanks, you know, and there's an email out to everybody. Thank you for all the hard work.
Thanks all. Yeah.
Yeah, that's crazy. So be specific, you know, write that email, go, hey, thanks, Dave, for blah, 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 blah. Thanks, Ahmad, for blah, 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 blah. You know, call it out. And the more specific you are, people start to realize, ooh, you're aware. You're like, you actually see me. And, you know, that's a human core need, is to be relevant and to be seen as relevant. Yep. So, you know, you recognize specifically, and you do the same thing with these career growth conversations. And what I believe with these one-on-ones is that at least one of them every month should be a checkup on that person's career growth path. So that assumes first you've started with, you have a career growth path that you've established, right? Typically do that at the beginning of the year. You'll work on it together. I keep it very simple. It's like a one-page snapshot, nothing laborious. Let's go through, what are your goals? What are you interested in learning? Where do you stand on this leadership maturity matrix? What are the gaps we want to close that we're going to work on together? And then once a month, you have a feedback loop on how they're doing against it. They can provide feedback. You can provide feedback. So by the time you get to the performance review, there are zero surprises. You've been talking about this for 12 months. And the performance review is just a formality. That's the way it should be.
Yep.
Because you've been having these conversations. And oh, by the way, as opportunities arise that match what that person's looking for, you can match them, right? Because you know, and you're having regular conversations and you're aware of what changes and what doesn't change. So I find that discipline to be very, very important. Now, that's just at the individual level. Right. So, once you have the insight on the individual, that allows you to take a step back and get a big picture view of how your team is scaling. Where are the gaps as a team? Where do we want to be going as a team? What is our path as a team? Where do we want to go? And really asking that. And that starts to build a team identity. Like, what are the values we espouse? What are we the blue collar? Guys that Ruby developers that are hardworking, and this is sort of our mentality. It's like a sports team, right? Sports teams take on a particular identity, and it changes from season to season sometimes, right? So they fit a particular profile, and they have fans that follow that. So, develop your identity, and that really helps with scaling because, as you're adding people, as you're recruiting, what's your brand beyond even just your company brand?
Yeah, I was going to say, when you espouse your ethos as a team by blogging or even doing video shorts or whatever you can do, speak at conferences, meetups, all of that, it shows people how awesome your team is or how cool it would be to work there, et cetera, or how cool it would not be to work there for that matter. But usually you're talking about cutting edge stuff, challenging stuff, and it shows like our team is, already using Kubernetes or whatever it is, anyways.
Yep.
Go ahead.
Yeah, that's right. And, if you don't mind, Dave, I'd love to read like a quick excerpt of something I wrote for a job description. And it just talks about ethos. So it says, we are looking for a real world, agile, pragmatic servant leader who tangibly contributes to relevant delivery. We believe in the integrity of our commitments as a team and look for a leader who can coach our teams as such. In addition, we are obsessed with relevance, making sure that everything the team does is relevant to our customers and our market. We believe in protection of the team in order to create the space and accountability to build solutions and architecture that last over time. We are a team of engineers that take pride in our work. We are not simply coders. So something like that, right? When you read that as a job description, you're looking for a job. You're like, I want to be a part of that. Like, I haven't even gotten to responsibilities and, requirements of the job or anything else. Like, I read that, I'm like, I'm already in. I want to be a part of that, right? So I think expressing ethos is really, really important. And often it's been discredited as the soft stuff, but this is the stuff that engages people for the long term, and it actually helps with retention too.
Absolutely. Yeah, people don't buy what you do. They buy why you're doing it.
That's exactly right. And why not only spend time on that, but, be more deliberate, like apply an engineering mindset to it. Like, how would we approach this as engineers, right? Break that down into tangible parts and actually attack it in a more deliberate way.
Yep. Like real specific tactics on just how you're making sure this happens. For example, you could expect things to happen organically all on their own. But really, if it's not observed, it's not respected, it's not probably really happening. And if your org is big and you used to do this stuff at 5 or 10 people, how are you getting it to happen when you have an org of, say, 75 or 120 or whatever it is?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So in terms of that, how do you scale and measure culture change at an enterprise scale? you know, part of it is what are you measuring, you know, and how are you using that measurement? And then how are you learning from that measurement and adjusting from it, right? So to give you one example, you know, just to share with you, you know, my belief about what are the values that make a good leader? Let's start there. So let's establish a baseline, and then let's talk about how you would measure it from an enterprise level. You know, number one value, and I mentioned this before, to me, is a sense of ownership. By that, I mean you have a sense of ownership about your team, about yourself, about the entire company. You invest more time in problem solving. You're a problem solver. You're not a problem reporter. You know, we get how hard your job is, okay? But you're actually spending time on the solutions. And the way I like to think of it is, you know, I'm a big basketball fan. It's like, you're in the game. You know, you're not on the sidelines going, I can't believe that shot that Dave took. You know, you're actually in the game. So if the team messes up, like, you're live in there. That's the mindset that we want in a leader. We want them to be a problem solver. We want to own it. I think the second is really having an engineering mindset, right? Having the not only the technical competency, right? Hey, can you do the job, right? But also, like, are you making hard decisions to improve the durability of the architecture over time? You know, there's all this pressure for us to take shortcuts just to deliver. Are you just, you know, going to be that drone that just, you know, the timeline is king? And, or are you going to step up as a technology partner and really kind of bring some options to the table to your business partner and say, look, I can do it in this time, but here are the risks, you know, in a year or in 6 months, or I could spend an extra 2 weeks or an extra month or whatever it is. And here's what that would be like. Am I embedding more feedback loops into my development? So I'm learning what's working well, what's not working well. And there's all sorts of ways that manifests itself, right? We think of automated testing automatically, but and unit testing, but there's all sorts of other ways how that can manifest itself too. You know, do I believe that people are a priority? We've talked a lot about people on this session today, but you know, accountability, I believe, needs to be transparent. In other words, it needs to be done in front of the team. that's how it works. It certainly works individually, but you know, for people to know that what we stand for as a team and as a leader it is alive and well, you need to do it in front of the team, right? And there are healthy ways to do it. You know, this is not about calling people out or shaming people, not at all. You know, there are games I've developed in the past where, you know, sort of showing by metrics how teams are performing, how many teams are, you know, really applying the patterns that we want, how many teams are, falling into the anti-pattern bucket in really specific ways, scoring them and making the healthy competition out of it. There's all sorts of ways around that. And I think the last value I'll just mention is knowledge by experience, you know, experiential knowledge. We want people, we want leaders who are operating from a place where they know it firsthand. They're not taking it as a rumor that they heard. They're not taking it secondhand from someone. They're not reading it off a PowerPoint or some sort of document. They know. They know their code. They know their product. They know their people. They know their customers because they do the hard work of knowing. And that kind of hard work provides a very solid foundation of reality. And you end up making good decisions because 99% of bad decisions are because we don't understand the root cause. And we jump to a solution that maps to nothing at all that we need, right? So that experiential knowledge allows us as a team and me as a leader to be very surgical in what we do because everything we change obviously impacts the team. So those are some values, right? So let's just take that as a baseline. How do you operationalize that, right? So one thing I do is actually have at the end, I mentioned retros earlier, Dave. So for all teams that are doing retros, assuming they're doing retros, at the end of the retro, I have them actually rate their leader against these values. So we do a fist of five, you know, 1 through 5, really quick. It takes 30 seconds, a minute. Say, all right, how did Ahmad do this sprint on ownership? And there's a definition, right? How did Ahmad do on experiential knowledge? You know, why or why not? Let's have a quick discussion on it. And so the team knows They can also rate themselves, right? So you can use this in all sorts of different ways. But in this example, the team's rating their leader. And so the leader knows he's going to get feedback on every sprint. Now, that's not necessarily something that goes into a performance review. But the team knows that the leader's there to serve them, and he or she's going to be held accountable against these values. Now, this is a way to make those values alive and well. And then you bubble that up a little bit further. You know, at the CTO level, you know, we build a dashboard and actually have these ratings measured, right? So now you have a measurement across all leaders in the organization. And that's just one light in the prism, right? There's multiple things you can measure. But you do that and you build a dashboard where I can look and I can see sort of trends around, you know, across all my teams. How are we doing on ownership? You know, what's going on? Ooh, we took a real dip here, or this particular team's having trouble with that. How can I help? Right? It's not a way to point the finger. It's like, hey, what's going on here, guys? Let's have a conversation, and maybe we can help you in some way or another. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that's a way sort of to establish the baseline. Then how do you operationalize it, and how do you measure it at an enterprise scale?
Yeah, that's great. Thanks very much for that. All right, so let's change gears over to the wild card round. This is these are stories about, you know, actually in this particular one, it's cringy interview stories, whether you're giving an interview or attending an interview, et cetera. I mean, the happy ones are like, you know, I went to the interview and then I got hired. Yay. But those aren't the interesting ones. So we want to talk about the other ones. You got any good stories that are worth sharing without any personal details of anybody?
Oh, boy, we need a few days. I have stories. Wow. So you're looking for the interesting stories. So to kind of reveal my I'm often pinged to help companies interview talent and their next leaders and even their next CTO and helping them figure out, is this the right person or not? So I've come up with all sorts of methods to figure that out. One thing that I do, and anyone listening to this obviously is going to get the secret now. I kind of play dumb on some technologies, right? And say, hey, you know, we'll compare to, and, you know, let me know what's going on here. And, you know, if they don't know, they can choose to try to BS me or simply say, I don't know. And you sort of figure out what's going on there. And I had one particular candidate in full confidence lay out the differences between these two frameworks that I asked about. And he was dead wrong the whole time. Right. It was going on and on really confidently. He thought I didn't know anything about them. And I just nodded my head. I mean, he must have talked for a good solid 10, 15 minutes on it. And after that, there was the silence. And he just looked at me really proud of himself, like, see, did it, you know. And I'm sure in most interviews, people who didn't know those frameworks, he probably would get a thumbs up because he spoke very eloquently. And, you know, there's a little silence. And then I finally just said, all of that was wrong. Let me walk you through it. And then I went to the whiteboard and I walked them through all of it. And needless to say, the interview was over. You know, but I've had some interesting ones. I had one where I interviewed a guy. I phone screened him. We had a good conversation. He was saying all the right things, you know, his beliefs about leadership, and he seemed technical. And then they flew him in for an interview. This was for one of my clients. And he came in, I mean, literally it was the week after, right? And he was, you know, I was scheduled, he had all day interviews, and I was scheduled to have lunch with him. I popped into his interview a little early, like at 11:45, just to say hello and, hey, you know, we'll see you soon. And he totally didn't remember me at all.
Oh,
he
no. Just
sort of, and I said, okay, well, you know, people talk to lots of people. I sort of wrote it off. That's fine. And I said, all right, well, I'll see you in 15 minutes. And I showed up 15 minutes later, and he didn't remember me again.
Oh, wow.
And he sort of shook my hand like it was the first time. And I was like, okay, that's odd. And then we walked into the elevator. You know, we're going downstairs to go to lunch. And he started asking me where I'm from. And I said, well, I'm from Los Angeles. And he said, no, where are you really from? You know, get one of those. And so I sort of answered, and he said, no, where are your parents from? You know, after I kept repeating the same answer, I'm from Los Angeles. And after that, he sort of got really defensive, and he goes, well, you know, I'm from India, but I'm really American. And, you know, I couldn't help it. Like, in my head, I was hearing that song, I'm Proud to Be an American, you know, as he was talking. And I was like, well, that's cool. Like, I'm perfectly fine with wherever you're from. Like, it's really not an issue, you know, but it seemed like a big issue for him. So the interview started really strangely, you know. And then we're walking across the street to go to lunch. And I asked him a question, and, you know, it's the middle of the street. There's a car coming, but it's a little far off. Like, we can definitely make it across the street. And he stops in his tracks in the middle of the street with his back to the car and just starts talking about, you know, answering my question. And the car is getting closer and closer. And I kind of asked him a few times, like, let's get moving. And he totally ignores me, just keeps talking. And it got to the point where the car got so close, I had to push him out of the way. Like, I had to push us both, like, out of the way. Like, I literally pushed him across the street. And it was like he woke up all of a sudden, looked back, and he saw how close the car was. And he grabbed my hand, and he insisted to hold my hand as he walked across the street. So it was just really this odd thing.
It's a little awkward.
Yeah, needless to say, like, he didn't get the job. But what the funny thing is, the story got out because I told a couple people after. And for the rest of the week, like, randomly, I pass somebody in the hallway, and they go, "Hey, Ahmad, need me to hold your hand?" You know, it was just like a thing. You know, it was kind of a joke. But, you know, what surprises me about these things is, you know, how many people in technology have such a lack of self-awareness and their impact. Of, you know, it's funny, but yeah, in a way, it's like you sort of think, like, well, how could you be doing that, right?
I'm not here to make fun of it. It sounds like something like he was extremely nervous, though, too. So, I mean, I'm sympathetic to that, actually. I'm not here to just laugh at it. But, yeah, it sounds like they're just really nervous, plus already awkward, you know. So that's a compounding effect right there, you know.
Yeah. So, anyway, there's been lots of things like that. I've had somebody interview that insisted to tell me about all the failures he had in his career, even though I was trying to, like, help him and say, well, hey, can you tell me about a positive thing that happened? And, you know, he would go back to a failed project or trashing his boss, or it was just, you know, it was like he was there for therapy, essentially, and not an interview. So there's all sorts of things like that.
Any other interesting anecdotes, stories, working with recruiters, good, bad, ugly, anything like that?
I've had recruiters switch out candidates where I talk to somebody and literally, like, it's a different person on the next call or in the in-person interview. You know, I've had things like that. But generally, I love the recruiters that I've worked with, and they've been really good, very conscientious, really trying to dig deep because, you know, the market's so competitive now.
Sure is.
Recruiters are very conscious of, you know, the spirit behind what we're looking for and what the candidate's looking for and figuring out a match, right? Because they want it to work. So in general, I've had some really good partnership with recruiters. I know it's a really tough job, and I respect that. I think, you know, the nightmare stories that we all experience are 1% of that population. I will tell you a quick story, though, about, you know, something that was a lesson learned for me. I'm kind of very old school about interviewing. Like, as an example, if you don't show up on time, like, you don't care about the job enough.
Oh, totally.
You know, so I'm very much like that. And many years ago, there was an interview. We were interviewing an architect on a Friday afternoon in Los Angeles. You know, traffic is crazy in LA on a Friday afternoon. And he was flying in, you know, and he flew in, I think, that morning, or there was something like that. Anyway, he was late. He was late 5 minutes already. My ticker's going off. Like, okay, he's not getting the job. Like, he doesn't care about it. No message, nothing. And then he finally messaged me maybe 20 minutes later. Said, "Look, I'm not familiar with LA. I'm running really late." And something in me just told me, like, just wait for him. Typically, you know, after that 15-minute mark, maybe I'm gone. Like, we're moving on, right? And I waited. I think he got there like 45 minutes late. You know, I went on my business and, you know, I had other things to do. And I interviewed him. It turned out, you know, he had a personal emergency. There were all sorts of things that were happening that made him late. And I'll tell you, like, when I interviewed him, I loved him. I mean, everything but that, right? He had the humility. He had the character. He had the drive. Technically, he was sharp. And he ended up being a really successful architect in the company for years to come. So I'm so glad that I stayed. And it taught me that, yeah, have your principles and have your standards. And really, you know, I am very principled. But there are times where, you know, you need to kind of look beyond that and kind of look at the spirit behind it, because you might miss out on a great person and a great candidate.
Absolutely. You have to see redeeming value in every person in every situation. But where they might start to breach that is, you know, managing the expectations, like you said. If your number is in the invite or whatever, and they, or your email for that matter, and they can just get, you know, give you a quick text on the fly, like, hey, bad traffic, whatever, blah, blah. Like, even the smallest little things I've gotten with first contact with candidates, I'm cool with pushing out with the short notice. What I don't like is we go 7-10 minutes into a scheduled call. I mean, I don't wait 10 minutes, but right. In fact, this was one of my wild card questions with LACTO last year or the year before, which is, how long do you sit on a call before you actually ditch? It could be 3 minutes, it could be seven, or, you know, is the sweet spot was
five to 10 for me.
Yeah, right around 5 to 10.
More than that. Yeah.
But yeah, even the best candidates, they may accidentally need to bail out at the last minute, but they tell you. And you're like, cool, all right, I'll give that a push, you know. But when they don't, oh gosh, you're not going to get a second chance usually.
Yeah, and I typically agree with that. I think also the thing that I think about too is that I would never be where I am today if there weren't leaders and certain people that, you know, gave me a shot early in my career when maybe I didn't even deserve to have one, you know, or I wasn't experienced enough. So, you know, not to say that it applies to this particular situation, but it just in general, it's like if you sort of see that diamond in the rough, you may be that person that plays a key role in their career growth and their career trajectory. And that's great.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember another participant in all of this said that they've worked with so many people, and the good tell for him is that they don't switch sides of the street when he comes walking down. You know, that's a good sign that people like want to talk to you again, even after you've worked together.
Yeah, I think that's great. You just made me think of something. Can I add one more thing?
Yeah, please.
On interviewing, I love to ask other people about the candidate other than the people that are interviewing the candidate. So the admin or the coordinator that's working with them, you know, throughout the day, the janitor, the front desk person, how are they received? You know, what's their impression of this candidate? Because, you know, there are things about, you know, measuring character too that don't necessarily show up in an interview. We've all had people that interview really well and then they start and you're like, ooh, oh man, that's a bad decision. So, you know, I like to try to get a more comprehensive view.
Yeah, you can test for level 6 ownership by seeing if they pick up that empty Snickers candy wrapper in the lobby where they walk in. It's intentionally planted there to see, you know, do they pick up the trash on the floor?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I know that's a little baity, but no, that does show extreme ownership when people just pick up trash or, you know, just the small things. It shows that they pay attention to the details sometimes, you know.
Yeah, wasn't there like an article a while back about, I think it was the Salesforce CEO or somebody, that their method of interview was take him to a particular breakfast spot and he tips the staff extra to get the candidate's order wrong just to see what do they do, you know, and that was his thing, you know. So, you know, I think things like that are insightful. Yeah, so I think in closing, you know, I, as I mentioned before, I believe my personal mission on this earth is to grow other leaders. And growing and scaling architecture is as much of a responsibility as it is growing and scaling people and doing both, you know. I'm the techie who loves people. So, you know, I'm all about building and developing code and developing leaders. And I really appreciate Dave the time to talk through some of the details behind that and some of the principles behind it, because, you know, a lot of this, our responsibility as leaders is to develop these things fostered in the knowledge of execution, right? Real world stuff, not the philosophical, not get out of the PowerPoints and get in with the people and really tangibly grow things. So I love, love, love doing that. Love talking about it, obviously, and really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, Ahmad, thanks for coming on. It's been a great conversation and I too really enjoyed it. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Dave.